Good afternoon.
My name is Andrea Anadar, and I'm a public health nutrition researcher at RTI International. And today I'm going to be talking about optimizing the combination of strategies used by food insecure households to ensure sufficient food. So we're going to bring everybody back to the domestic U.S., but this is really going to build off of the three previous presenters and sort of tie things a little bit, I think, together. So thank you to them. I want to acknowledge Dan Sicaro and Sarah Kandeffer, who are two statisticians that helped me with some of these numbers. We're going to go a little more number heavy than some of the other ones, so sorry in advance for that. And before I begin, I have no financial disclosures to disclose. Okay, so just a little bit of background to get everyone up to speed. So recognizing the burden of food insecurity, already back in World War II, Congress developed a national nutrition safety net that's composed of both food programs and financial assistance programs, like medical, energy assistance, tax credits. This is what I'm calling, when we talk about combination of strategies, safety net programs. These are the governmental, primarily federal assistance programs, SNAP, WIC, school meal programs, SSI, SSDI. Complementing these safety net programs, or these governmental assistance programs, as previous folks have talked about, are the non-governmental assistance programs. These are what we used to call emergency food providers, but have become much more mainstream, less acute, more chronic, so we just calling them now non-governmental providers, food pantries, soup kitchens. And then going along with these, even in spite of these programs, knowing that one in four Americans right now are participating in one of those 1 in 15 federal assistance programs, we still have this combination of individually developed strategies that folks are using to make ends meet, to ensure sufficient food for the family. And what we've done with our research is classify these into six categories of things people do to either directly acquire food or more money to get food to still connect those pieces. And those are financial, food safety, physical, nutritional, legal, regulatory, or no known risk. And we'll come back to those categories. So these are the three types of strategies when I say I'm trying to figure out how do these fit together. So the purpose of this research project was to determine the prevalence of these coping strategies, all three types again, used by very low food secure households with children. These are the worst off, if you will, about 5% of the population in North Carolina, and understand the prevalence of the coping strategies by type, so six categories, and then to look at the association and the interplay among them. So what I'm talking about today, this is a mixed method study. You're only going to get the interplay part, the real quantitative-y part. But it was a mixed method study that that was conducted in 2014. I don't expect you to be able to see this, but what this is trying to show in that right circle block is what we are trying to get at with this question. So we know people are participating in these safety net programs. We know that they're using food pantries and soup kitchens. We know that they're also doing these other individually developed risky strategies. What we were trying to figure out was, how did the different pieces go up and down, and what affects that? So ideally, right, we should see if a person's participating in SNAP, maybe has a child on WIC, and then they're going to a food pantry once a month. Ideally, we would expect, right, that the risky behaviors that they use, those things that pose nutritional or food safety or physical risk, would go down. And if they weren't taking part in these programs for whatever reason, access, lack of awareness, stigma, we would expect those risky behaviors to go up. So what we tried to do was develop a model that would sort of predict, based on these different individual level characteristics that the other presenters have talked really nicely about, these modifying conditions, household income, participation in programs, different predictors of food security, race, marital status, etc., how those would factor into this model. Okay, so what did we do? This research builds on work that I worked on when I was at both Rutgers and Johns Hopkins, and then was further played out with this. This is the University of Kentucky Center for Poverty Research study. And what we did was we built on the New Jersey and Hopkins work to develop an instrument and test it. we selected, and the instrument listed all these different practices that people can do and different programs that they might participate in. We then selected counties with the highest rate of food insecure households with children, and we used Feeding America's Map the Meal Gap, because you can actually look at household food security by county level. And then we conducted key informant interviews to select different sites where we were going to do our research. We then conducted, as the first part of this, the quantitative piece, in-person survey interviews with clients of service providers for limited resource individuals. Everybody had to be eligible, you had to be adult responsible, able to talk about what, how you acquired the different food and what programs your household participated in. You had to have children in your household, and then you had to qualify as very low food secure household with children. I can tell you right away, I told the folks at Kentucky, I said, I'm not going to be able to do this study with households with very low food secure food security with children. It's too rare. I'll never get the number I need. And unfortunately, North Carolina is not doing so well right now, and especially probably a little worse so now. We had a lot of counties with over 30% of households fitting the map, the meal gap, and we had an N of 320 households. I thought I'd run out of money before I could recruit that many, but anyways, that's another side note. Okay, so we had this, so what did we do with this data? We did the basic, you know, descriptive stats, counts and percentages to tally what different programs folks were participating in, and to describe the sample and characterize the population, standard things. We then did odds ratios, chi-square statistics to try to describe the magnitude and strength of the association among those coping strategies, types, and those safety net and non-governmental programs. And then the thing to get at the interplay we did was develop these log linear models to analyze the interdependencies. How do these different strategies all fit together? So what I'm going to do now going forward is talk about how those models were developed. But first, basic respondents. What do these folks look like? The majority were female, not surprisingly. We were recruiting, remember, largely at providers serving this population, and they mainly were food pantries and soup kitchens. So the majority were female, black, they reported citizenship, that's just important for eligibility requirements of the programs, and were unemployed. But I think it is important to note that 5% indicated that they were full-time employed. And still remember, this is all very low food security. And I also think it's important to note that we had quite a few that reported zero income households, which is something that I know in the field we're seeing a lot more of. So look at that. Under $500 a month, 34% of the population. That's the income that they're reporting. In terms of those safety net programs, so household food assistance, not surprisingly, you know, self-selection, we can say bias too, 76% were on WIC, 76%, I'm sorry, were on SNAP, 24% on WIC. 140 of the 320 participants did have a child that was 0 to 5, so that's not surprising. It's probably a little surprising that it's actually as low as it is given those demographics. In terms of the financial assistance, we're just touching this real briefly, SSI or SSDI, just over 50%, and then Medicaid or Medicare, 84% of the population. Reporting any financial, 95% population. So that's that one prong of our three prong. Then carrying that over, and again, remember where I recruited, food pantry, 97% almost of the participants took part in there, and close to 52% of soup kitchens. Of course, these aren't mutually exclusive. This was just one of the questions I thought was interesting to share with you. It's not really the focus, but you know, we asked the quintessential question, how much of the time are you short on food? In spite of reporting all of these, participating in these programs, so they've gone through, they've told us they're financial and they're feeding assistance, we still have almost 45% that are 2 weeks or more of the month are short on food. And then carry that over with how much money would you need to close this gap in food. And you can see there, 27% thought they needed more than $200 a month. And I thought that question was important to ask to, you know, get back to USDA when they're talking about SNAP allocations and allotments. Okay, so what are some of these now, so we've done the supplemental and we've done the safety net program. These are the individual developed coping strategies, just examples of what falls into these. So nutritional, that's under or over nourishment, right? So skipping meals, diluting food or drinks. This includes baby formula, which we call that separately. High risk, right? Food safety, damaged packages, removing slime from lunch meat, eating food that was thrown away by somebody else. Physically risky, you're not following prescriptions as they're recommended. You're either not filling them or you're diluting them. You're prostituting to ensure that you have sufficient food. You're going to prison to ensure that you get meals sufficiently served. We had 11 questions. We had 52 total of these individually developed strategies. 11 of them fit into the nutritionally risky, 11 food safety, 6 financial, 10 illegal or regulatory concerns, 5 physically, and then importantly, 13 did not pose a risk to people. And these questions were qualified previously when with some work at Rutgers using different experts, faculty, literature reviews were put into these categories. I can point you to where they're categorized in other journals. So what did we do? In order to put them in a model, though, we had to come up with cut points. Based on the data distributions to allow us to, you know, put in robust predictive variables. So for each category, we distributed them and came up with categories to inform our model. So for example, in order to be financially counted as high risk, using high risky financial behaviors, we set a threshold of 4. You had to do 4 or more to be considered high risk. Food safety, you had to do 5 or more. Illegal, 2, nutritional, 7, just to show the commonality. No risk, at least 8 of those. And you can see, just on the right side, I know I'm going through this pretty quickly, how common, though, to do these risky behaviors they were. 98% did something that was financially risky. This is writing bad checks for food. This is using credit at the corner bodegas. Skipping bills or moving bills around so you have enough money for food. 98% almost did something in food safety risk. 77% something illegal. And almost 100% something we would, nutrition experts would consider risky. Okay, so that's how, I can't ask you if that makes sense, but how we came up with the thresholds. So first thing, just to form the model, we looked at what demographics, that left side of the model, were associated with different risk groups to inform the model, right, to get some initial associations. And the 3 variables that really stood out as associated with using these risky behaviors were gender, income, and age. Employment, education, and race were tested, but not significant. So here you can see, and I think it's really interesting just to look at women. Much less likely to do, significantly less likely to do something financially risky than their male counterparts. And then look at the males with the illegal or regulatory, which we can sometimes say, you know, based on gender stereotypes, may not be that surprising. 80% were compared to 20% for the illegal or risky. And then this just carries over again in looking at the income. And importantly, again, those who are making more income, much less likely to use these highly financially risky strategies than those with lower incomes. And it almost trends quite nicely down. And that goes the same for the really, the legal, illegal, and regulatory. So, and we found, interestingly, that income was the predictor versus employment, which isn't all that surprising given we didn't know anything about their employment status, their wages. And income was a household level variable versus just employment of the respondent. So, okay. And then this one I think is particularly interesting, looking at the age category. It's a perfect, note the trend, as they age, they do fewer and fewer risky financial behaviors. And the same thing goes for the illegal regulatory. It almost perfectly goes up. So it's just one of those trends. Okay. So we had our demographic associations, and then we started with some summary of two-way associations. And I'm going to go pretty quickly through this. So again, just to inform those more complicated three-way ones, we had to build up to them. So what we ended up doing, we used so soup kitchen users tend to be, just in the literature, more risky, worse off financially than their food pantry counterparts. So putting them in the model, we saw that soup kitchen users were significantly more likely to do at least 4 financially risky strategies, 2.4 times more likely for food safety, and 2.3 times more likely to use illegal behaviors to ensure sufficiency of food. And importantly, but I just don't have time to note, nutrition and no other risk were also associated in a similar fashion. Okay, and then we categorized, to get at a little bit of a dose response, food pantry usage. And all 6 risk categories, the coping strategies, were tested, and food safety was the only one in this association to pop up as a strong dose response. But you can see a direct, more often you go to food pantries, the more likely you are to engage in food safety risk. Okay, we're just whizzing through these. So now we get to really the meat of it, the three-way associations. Within this one that stands on, I'm just highlighting some important ones, was within the group not receiving no SSI or SSDI, the association is strong for soup kitchen users versus nutritionally risky behaviors. However, within the group receiving the SSI, the association is weaker. And so the interaction effect as a result becomes marginal, suggesting that there is a true effect modification, but not enough data to detect it statistically. Remember, we only have 320 cases, which I thought was really big, but when you're trying to sort them and put them into these types of models, it's challenging. So we can see the effect of the association between the soup kitchen users and the risky behavior, though, is different between those who receive SSI, SSDI, and those who do not. And then we get to school foods. So among households reporting that they're getting some sort of support from their school food programs, the percentage is the most intensive in the food pantry use who reported more food safety risky behaviors compared to those who do use the food pantry less. So respondents who reported a similar reported school food support exhibited a similar trend, but not as pronounced, again resulting in that marginal interaction effect, suggesting a trend, but again, probably lack of power. So, but we know that the effect of the association between food pantry users and risky behavior is different among those receiving school food and those who do not. Okay, and then there's this one. This is SNAP users and non-users who visit soup kitchens. And we see here that those who are reporting no SNAP and SNAP were statistically significantly more likely than soup kitchen users to report engaging in food safety risky behaviors. However, there's no interaction effect. So this really shows that SNAP does not affect the association between soup kitchen use and food safety risk. So what does that mean? SNAP is not making soup kitchen users any different. It overall brings everyone's effect of engaging in risky behaviors down. So it's working. Okay, so gender, income, age associated with use of coping strategies. We saw that loud and clear. Soup kitchen users are more likely to use potentially risky coping strategies, not so surprising. Food pantry users less strongly associated, but the sample selection could account for this limited explanation. Again, we surveyed at primarily soup kitchens and food pantries. Among soup kitchen users, SSI and SSDI potentially modifies the effect of risky nutritional and financially coping strategies. And SNAP overall reduces the use of risky food safety coping strategies. Among food pantry users, school food programs potentially modify the effects of risky food safety coping strategies. This research would really benefit from an increased sample size, right? We always need to do bigger studies. And then some variability in the sample. I would love to see if we hadn't just looked at those very low food secure. I mean, it was awesome to be able to focus on them, but put a little variation in there, and I think it's going to make these models snap. So just some high-level conclusions. I think this research makes a strong case for maintaining and strengthening our public and private assistance programs, both the federal safety net and the supplemental non-governmental organizations. Increasing the benefit amounts, performing outreach to improve participation, make people aware of them. And then keep in mind, 99.7% of individuals in this study use some non-risky strategy. What that means is, all those individual things that people are doing, there are quite a few that don't pose any risk. And it's a shame people have to do them, but they're prudent. So if you get back into sort of nutrition education or behavioral modification, not looking just at the program policy, there are strategies that we know individuals are doing now that we can direct them to do that would be far less risky than those other ones, trade-offs. So thanks very much for your time.